Hi there, listeners. It's Farnoosh, and I just want to say I'm really honored that you've chosen to subscribe to So Money. I know there are a lot of podcasts out there. The fact that you're here is not lost on me. Now, if you're enjoying these episodes and you're benefiting from the advice and you want more, I've actually created something really special for us. It's called the So Money Members Club. It's an online platform where you can connect more closely with me and engage with fellow So Money fans who want to become more empowered in their financial lives. The website is SoMoneyMembers.com. And when you go there, you'll learn all the benefits, including exclusive monthly finance workshops, private group calls with me. You get your questions answered in our member community. I'm often in there weighing in, and you get instant access to all of our workshop recordings. We have a robust library that's growing. So far, we've had workshops on investing in real estate, kids and money, and how to earn more in 2024. And most of all, it's fun, positive, encouraging, all the things personal finance should be. Go to SoMoneyMembers.com, and I hope you'll join us. I'm limiting enrollment, and doors will close soon. Check out SoMoneyMembers.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hosting the So Money podcast for almost 10 years, I've been learning a lot about how to best serve you outside the show. I've begun to offer pop-up workshops and a So Money members club. And with each new line of business, a lot goes on behind every transaction. Stripe helps simplify and ease payments with Tap to Pay on iPhone, which helps me grow revenue and reach through accepting more in-person contactless payments when I'm out in real life promoting my programs. Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe give me the ability to scale quickly and stay flexible with quick setup and no additional hardware required. And it's not just ideal for me. From local pop-ups to global retailers, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe help businesses of all sizes accept contactless payments right from an iPhone. Whether your customers want to use their card, Apple Pay, or other digital wallet, now you can accept contactless payments right from an iPhone. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone. So Money, episode 1561, Donovan X. Ramsey, author of When Crack Was King.
You're listening to So Money with award-winning money guru Farnoosh Torabi. Each day, get a 30-minute dose of financial inspiration from the world's top business minds, authors, influencers, and from Farnoosh herself. Looking for ways to save on gas or double your double coupons? Sorry, you're in the wrong place. Seeking profound ways to live a richer, happier life? Welcome to So Money.
We didn't learn the lessons of the crack era, that, you know, the crack epidemic is something that happened in our country and it really impacted cities and communities of color in particular. And, you know, once it was over, we just moved on. And it's because we didn't learn the lessons and improve our system that we're still vulnerable to drug epidemics like the opioid epidemic, and why not only are we vulnerable, but we don't have solutions in place to actually help people, you know, once they're caught up in whatever their drug of choice is. So for me, you know, I really hope that by telling these stories that we could learn from them. So it was important to not just get the sort of meta history, the rise and fall of crack, but to also tell the stories of the individuals impacted. So that way we could look to the ways that they dug themselves out of the epidemic and came out on the other end as survivors.
Welcome to So Money, everybody. I'm Farnoosh Torabi. Today, we're going to explore what my guest calls a misunderstood era, the 1980s and 1990s, when the crack epidemic became a harrowing experience for thousands of Americans. If we care about what's behind existing wealth gaps and opportunity gaps today, history is sometimes our greatest teacher. But chances are, when we think of the crack era, our minds go to how it was depicted in the media, or political campaigns and policing. Do we really know the people who suffered and what happened to them? And while some suffered, others profited. How did the failures of that epidemic haunt and hold back our plight against drugs, as well as social justice and wealth equality then and still today? Donovan X. Ramsey is our guest and the author of the new book, When Crack Was King, A People's History of a Misunderstood Era. The book came out in July, has fast become acclaimed, featured everywhere, including a review, a long review, in the New York Times. It's kind of an author's dream. And the writer says, Donovan aims to give the story of the crack epidemic a human face while telling it from start to finish, a Herculean task. By and large, he succeeds. Fun fact, everybody, Donovan and I go way back. I have goosebumps as I open this episode. I had goosebumps the entire time recording it with him. He was my intern. That makes me sound really, really old. But the fact of the matter is, he and I kind of grew up in the trenches of journalism. I'm a bit further ahead, but he is by and large a far better writer than I ever will be. His work is making a very important impact. I'm just blown away that I had the opportunity in my lifetime to be able to collaborate with him. And it is with great honor that I bring him on the show. He's been on the show before. This won't be his last. And although we've both come quite far in our careers, we begin this episode with the two of us fumbling a bit with our audio, but we got it working. A little behind the scenes for you as we kick things off. Here we go. Here's Donovan X. Ramsey. Are you good? Or you just let me know when you're ready.
The source is my Yeti. Okay.
All right.
Look at me acting like a pro.
You are a pro. Donovan Ramsey, welcome to So Money. Not only are you good at setting up your own audio for a podcast, but you are a masterful writer. And I like to say, I knew you when. I knew you when you were a bright-eyed, starry-eyed young man, and you're still a young man, but you had just graduated from Columbia Journalism School where I went. And I think it was just an alignment of stars. You were able to work with me as I was also trying to build this ship. And together we kind of grew up in this world of journalism and writing and trying to make a business out of all the things. And you always had the highest of intentions and ambitions with your writing and your impact. And I'm so blown away by your first of many books that I'm sure you're going to write. But this now is called When Crack Was King. I'm getting goosebumps because I remember the day you told me about this book and the deal, and it was before the pandemic. And I thought, oh, the world needs this book. And then of course, 2020 happened. And I feel like maybe sometimes it's important to let a book sort of take its process. Like, so glad that you didn't rush to write this book in 2018, that you are now coming out with it now when it is even more relevant, maybe sadly, but more relevant. But When Crack Was King, I want to hand you the mic, A People's History of a Misunderstood Era, as you have experienced it, as you've interviewed four prominent characters in this book, a kaleidoscope of storytelling about this prominent time in our country's history that was so misunderstood and has implications to this day of how we police, how we think about equity. And so take it away. What prompted you to want to write this particular piece of our history and correct the record?
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me, Farnoosh. This is, you know, we get to talk every now and then on the mic, but I just always like spending time with you. You know, I had the privilege, for folks that may not know, to assist you for a period when I was out of J school, and to also, you know, see you work on your books. And that was a part of what really encouraged me to like pursue book writing as a part of my career. So I got to be on record saying thank you for allowing me to witness that.
Well, thank you, Donovan. You were instrumental. And I, like I say, like, it was an alignment of stars. I mean, it was not an accident. I think that we met and that we collaborated. And I think you've more than just an assistant. You were a collaborator. And I so enjoyed mentoring you and watching you. And so anyway, what a joy. I mean, this book, I said to myself, I hope he's proud of himself.
Yeah. I know. I'm super proud because it's the book that I set out to write. So, you know, I entered journalism, wanting to write about Black life and also about, you know, the parts of Black life that can be not so enjoyable or like glamorous. And that includes like the criminal legal system and the ways that Black folks get swept up in it. And, you know, in my experience writing many of those stories, people would talk about the crack era, but they never talked about it in the same ways or using the same terms. And I realized that there was that like people's memories were inconsistent around what happened. So, you know, I set out to find a book that would explain it to me just as a reporter. And I realized that that book doesn't exist. So, you know, something that I learned from you on the business side is that that means that there's probably a market for it, right? That,
right.
You know, if people have those questions and they're talking about it for sure, but the book doesn't exist, then and that's the book that you have to write. Mm-hmm. So that's what
And you did it. And more than that, too, it's that, you know, it starts with curiosity. You come to this realization that a lot of people have the same questions, but that it's the answers that will make the impact. It's the answers to these questions that might spark change. And So why is When Crack Was King so important to read today in terms of informing us to hopefully create that impact and change that's so necessary in our plight for social justice, equity, which you've been on the show many times. We've talked about these things. Tell us about what you hope will come out of this book.
Yeah. Well, you know, we didn't learn the lessons of the crack era, that, you know, the crack epidemic is something that happened in our country and it really impacted cities and communities of color in particular. And, you know, once it was over, we just moved on. And it's because we didn't learn the lessons and improve our system that we're still vulnerable to drug epidemics like the opioid epidemic. And why not only are we vulnerable, but we don't have solutions in place to actually help people, you know, once they're caught up in whatever their drug of choice is. So for me, you know, I really hope that by telling these stories that we could learn from them. So it was important to not just get the sort of meta history, the rise and fall of crack, but to also tell the stories of the individuals impacted. So that way we could look to the ways that they dug themselves out of the epidemic and came out on the other end as survivors.
And you do this through four main characters in your book. You yourself also a main character. Of course, the writer is always a main character. But in the introduction, you talk about when you were a child and sort of when you were first introduced to this epidemic, how it was articulated, how it was talked about, was very impactful. Tell us about your choice to tell this through the lens of these four individuals. And I just think it was so smart. I mean, first of all, Hollywood, I know we're doing a strike right now, but I anticipate a bidding war for the rights to this book because it has clear adaptation potential and cinematic. And I mean, you've already developed the characters and they are real people. So there's no like, you know, imagination there. But tell us why these four particular people were crucial to this 360 that you wanted to provide on looking at the crack epidemic.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that journalism does not do well is sort of fleshing out the stories of vulnerable people that, you know, too often we kind of fill those gaps with stereotypes. And then these people that are complex just become, you know, these like flat caricatures. So I realized that that the only way to really do the history justice was to add memory to it, that there was the history that was there from official documents and news reports. And what that was always missing was this human element of how people were impacted. And that's something that you can only really do by harnessing people's memories as sometimes inconsistent and faulty as they can be. You know, that you have to start kind of throwing them in the pot to arrive at a larger truth. So, you know, that was why I didn't go with just one character, but four characters that offered different perspectives from different cities. So that way readers would have not just that, again, that larger rise and fall, but these narratives that they could compare and contrast.
What were some of the patterns I mean, clearly differences across four different people, different cities, different life experiences, but were there patterns that you picked up on that then shaped and informed maybe like, this is the narrative. This is the narrative about the crack epidemic that we don't hear enough about.
Yeah, that's a great question. The first thing that I found in my research was that first I had to identify which cities were the hardest hit. Because, you know, I was doing like the plan at first was just to focus on one city. I was going to do Washington, D.C. And I was interviewing people in D.C. and I realized, oh, their story is very different from those of people in New York or people in Los Angeles. So then I looked at the hardest hit cities and I saw, you know, to the one that they have been these great migration cities that Black folks sort of left the South for in search of like industrial jobs and, you know, sort of like a working class life. And that those cities in the 70s, you saw deindustrialization and what had been working class neighborhoods where people owned houses and, you know, had families became ghettos because of the concentrated poverty. And that, and also that, you know, during the 60s and 70s, they were riot cities, like almost to the one. They had been the sites of major riots, usually about policing or housing conditions. So what that did was it helped me connect the crack epidemic to these larger forces. And then to also be able to identify disaffection, you know, that it's a term that we use today when we talk about people in the Midwest and the Rust Belt and the South that are using opioids, that people can become so hopeless that they want to just check out. But it's not a term that we really apply to folks during the crack epidemic.
Right.
I was able to identify that this community of people, that they were disaffected and that that's why they wanted to check out with a substance that made them feel good, cocaine. Yeah.
The role of race in the portrayal of the crack epidemic, and I should say racism in this, in the crack epidemic, the way that it was communicated and branded and the fear that was, you know, sort of surrounded this. When we were talking a long back before the before times about the genesis of this book and sort of what you were, the things you were picking up on very early stages was just that law enforcement was leveraging this epidemic to use it as almost like a weapon against Black Americans, when in reality, most drug users in this country are white Americans. And I thought, oh my gosh, that is so true. Can you talk about that a little bit more? Because I think that's so important. I mean, when you brought up meth, I thought the meth epidemic, again, largely a white American crisis. And there's so much more empathy around this, I think, in our culture about like trying to find solutions and mental health and getting to the root of it. And why do people do this? And it's not that they're just druggies. It's that they just like they're led to this because, and you brought, you mean, you touched on this. That was not what was the narrative, of course, during the crack epidemic. And so what else did you discover about the role of racism in the portrayal of the crack epidemic?
Yeah, that, you know, it's so sad that we failed to learn the lessons of the crack epidemic because it was something that we associated with Black and Latino people in big cities. That that because those were the folks that became the face of crack, the nation kind of just decided, oh, well, that happened to those people because they're bad people. So we can move on without ever investigating it. And what that means is that we just didn't. That we weren't curious about it, right? I mean, even the fact that I am writing this authoritative history, you know, all these years later and that no one else did it is because we weren't curious enough about why it happened. That people had just decided, oh, you know, that happened to them for the obvious reasons. And, you know, the way that it also plays out on a policy level is that we get policies that are race neutral on their face, that they're just about crime, that they're just about drugs, but that those policies are applied unequally. So, you know, or sometimes you get racist laws, you know, so you'll get something like, I mean, I would argue a racist law, the 100-to-1 disparity in sentencing between crack and powder cocaine, where basically you would get 100 times, you know, or it took 100 times the amount of powder cocaine to get the same sentence as crack cocaine. So let's say 500 grams of powder cocaine versus, 100 grams of powder cocaine versus 1 gram of crack cocaine. And the sentence was 5 years for each. Well, the impact of that is that you're going to police people unequally. You're going to arrest Black folks, especially for possession of crack. And then those folks not only go to prison, but they stay in prison. And that's how we get a situation like mass incarceration. So, you know, race is this confusing, distracting factor in American life, that it's something that makes otherwise, you know, curious and intelligent people put aside their ability to think and to just, you know, to embrace fear and to embrace shame. And, you know, fear and shame are just where every bad thing happens.
They're just like first cousins. Yeah, I think what one of the references in your introduction is about Whitney Houston, and she was abusing crack cocaine. She denied it because part of it was that there was a stigma about like whoever uses this is poor. It's a poor person's drug. And she, of course, didn't want that branding. And what are some of the other like myths around this drug use, this particular drug use that you found to be pervasive? And again, maybe even intentional branding, because, or it was false associations that we had. It's just so sad, the whole thing. But like, what else did you discover on in that realm?
Well, on the topic of Whitney Houston, who I absolutely love, you know, that she did an interview with Oprah, you know, when she was in a period of recovery, where she talked about how she smoked base, she called it, with marijuana. So, you know, base was one of the original names for crack cocaine. But it was very clear in that interview that I don't even think she knew that she was smoking crack. So, you know, it's funny how, you know, somebody could become vulnerable to crack addiction through that kind of stigma being associated with crack. So somebody says, oh, this isn't crack, this is base. So now you feel free to use it and you ultimately become addicted.
Wow.
But I'll say, in terms of the things that we misunderstand about the myths, first, there was this idea that crack was a super drug, which it was not. That crack is the same substance as powder cocaine. It just simply is consumed differently. And because it was consumed differently, it is metabolized in the body differently. So anything that you smoke goes directly to your brain. And that means that you get immediately high, but that high is short-lived. So therefore, it's something that people binge. And I would compare for, you know, any of our listeners that have used marijuana, it's like when you have an edible and you think, oh, that edible didn't do a thing. And then an hour later, you're high out of your mind for the next 24 hours, you know, versus smoking a joint.
It's, we are not speaking from experience, listeners.
No.
That's what we've read in the newspapers.
No, I barely drink coffee. But that is, you know, similar. So, you know, that was a myth. And out of that myth came this idea, right, that like crack addicts were then these like zombies, that they were people that became immediately addicted, and that were a different level of addict.
Yeah. And thus gave police force the authority and permission and support to be aggressive and violent against a very specific group of people to for their forcefulness to be justified. And yet obviously that was, I mean, we've done so many pieces on race on this show, and every time, if there's ever a piece of you that wonders, oh, maybe it was just all coincidence, or it was just an accidental thing, or they didn't intend it, this was by design.
Yes.
This was by design. This was intentional. This was an opportunity they couldn't afford to neglect. They thought, oh, we've got something here. And this is a pattern in history. So the crack epidemic is an example of that. But, you know, I saw, is it 13th, the 13th?
Yeah, exactly.
And the history of police violence and the continued racism, like we may have quote unquote freed the slaves. And yet, of course, like, no. What other moments in our history do you see this being in parallel to, in terms of here's cultural phenomenon. This is a drug epidemic in this case that was used against a group of people, in this case, Black Americans, African Americans. But there are other examples of this, you know, of these playing out in other cultures, other races throughout the world in our country. But in your research, did you find parallels, which would then corroborate even your thesis?
Yeah.
Like, this is not a new thing. This is what people do. This is what people in authority positions do to sort of, you know, keep their authority.
This podcast is brought to you by eHarmony, the dating app to find someone you can be yourself with. Why doesn't eHarmony allow copy and paste in first messages? Because you are unique and your conversations should reflect that. eHarmony wants you to find someone who will get you. How are you going to know who gets you? If people send you the same generic conversation starters, they message everyone else. Conversations that actually help you get to know each other. Imagine that. Get who gets you on eHarmony. Sign up today.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
The weather's getting warmer as I record. It's a nice 73 degrees on the East Coast. So finally, time to say goodbye to jackets and sweaters and, fingers crossed, hello to shorts and tees. And I need to update my wardrobe for the long haul. And, you know, I don't want to spend a fortune. So luckily, I found Quince. I'm honest. I've got a lineup of timeless pieces from Quince that keep me looking effortlessly chic year after year. I'm talking premium European linen dresses, blouses and shorts from $30, washable silk tops, timeless 14-karat gold jewelry, and tons more. Best part, all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. I have t-shirts from Quince, pajamas from Quince. My very chic and fashionable sister-in-law, Hannah, her whole closet is Quince. And people often stop us and ask, where did you get this? Don't tell me the price. And then when I do, they're shopping on Quince.com. Get warm weather ready with Quince. Go to Quince.com/somoney for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's Quince.com/somoney to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/somoney. For the longest time, I dreaded buying bras. It was like shopping for jeans. Impossible. You want a bra that's sexy, you want a bra that's comfortable, you can't have both. Well, now you can, thanks to Third Love. Third Love was started to take all the frustration, the ick, the ugh, out of bra shopping. That's why they make solutions for every bra problem or brablem. Their bras make it easy to bring back perkiness you haven't seen since high school. Get smoothing, you know where, and have straps that actually stay put. Designed at their headquarters in San Francisco and made with premium materials, they put every style through hours of wear testing on real women, including themselves, before it's given the stamp of boob approval. Comfort and support are guaranteed. Plus, whether you're a AA cup or an H cup, their virtual fitting room will help you find your perfect fit fast. They even invented half cups. No more feeling stuck between two cup sizes that don't fit. It's time to get your problems solved. Visit thirdlove.com and get $15 off your order with the code podcast15.
Well, you know, drugs are so interesting in American history because we've had really drug scares and drug hysteria almost as long as we've been a country.
Right.
So, you know, there was panic
the
around.
Program. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. But, you know, even before that, right? So you think about something like Reefer Madness and the association of Mexican-Americans with marijuana and the policies, you know, throughout the Southwest that came out of this idea that, you know, Mexican men hopped up on weed were dangerous. You know, we are a country that prohibited alcohol for a period, you know, which we often forget about, that like our country was so on fire about alcohol intoxication that we completely prohibited it. And still, you know, there are lots of places in the Midwest and in the South where you can't buy alcohol on a Sunday. Mm-hmm. That's the country that we live in, you know. Yeah. With cocaine specifically, there was a cocaine craze and hysteria around it in the early 1900s, where you know, organizations like the New York Times published articles about Negro cocaine fiends and this idea that Black men, in particular, became impervious to bullets when intoxicated with cocaine.
Yeah.
Like, you know, doctors wrote that in the New York Times. And so in drugs, I want to say, are so interesting because they are a fact of life, that we are, you know, these biological machines that operate on substances. Mm-hmm. So whether your substance of choice is sugar or caffeine or salt or fat, right, that it's like how we energize and just move our bodies. Mm-hmm. So drugs are a fact of life. Substances, I should say, are a fact of life. So they are things that you can, and by you, I mean politicians, can pick and choose what to criminalize, mm-hmm, as a political tool, as a way of targeting people. When Richard Nixon started the war on drugs in earnest in the 70s, it was because he wanted to target the anti-war left and the Black Panther Party. Mm-hmm. And hippies and Black Panthers were associated with drugs. Mm-hmm. So, you know, from the war on drugs very beginning, it was a political tool. And there's one last thing that I want to say on the topic, which is, you know, the way that we have, as a nation, executed the war on drugs has almost always been about drug possession and hardly ever about drug trafficking into the United States.
And how does it even get here? Right. That was my other question to you way back earlier in the interview, but I was like, some group, I'm not going to name names, but they were incentivized to keep this epidemic going. A lot of problems in our country are homegrown, and there is movements to keep the problems persisting because people are profiting. Yeah. And I don't know enough to know who are, but you've done the research and you might have some theories, but tell us about that.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's, it was, I go all the way back in the book to like the history of cocaine. So, you know, that the cocaine as a substance starts, you know, from coca leaves in the Andes, in South and Central America, and people chewing on coca leaves as a way of having energy to climb mountains and to do work, which sounds familiar, right? As we drink our coffee, that people consume a substance to become more productive. But that substance has high potential for addiction and abuse. Right. So once it became more popular around the world, you know, that there was a entire industry in South and Central America that grew out of it. So powder cocaine has been, you know, a popular substance for, you know, over a century now. And in the 80s, there were groups in Central America that the U.S. government wanted to support in terms of their political activities. But we did not have approval from Congress to do so, to disrupt foreign governments. So, you know, it's well documented. I'm not, you know, breaking news by saying this, but the U.S. government turned a blind eye, mm-hmm, while those groups, namely the Contras in Nicaragua, trafficked tons of cocaine into the United States. And it is from that glut of cocaine in the 70s and 80s that the crack epidemic was born.
Wow. My gosh. And we're not conspiracy theorists, y'all. This is, as Donovan said, well documented. The truth is hard. It's really, really hard to face. Yeah. And thank you for doing the hard work of bringing the truth to the forefront. What are some of the reactions you're getting from your book? I mean, outside of, let's just say, the New York Times and NPR and LA Weekly, this book is being celebrated across all the literati. But from everyday folks, I'm sure you're getting a lot of thank yous. Because this was a very traumatic chapter in our history, a lot of lives lost, a lot of lives still affected. And I'm sure to have this now on the record is, it feels good. It's like someone's finally paying attention and listening and saying, I see you. I know what really happened, and I'm going to tell everybody.
Yeah. The thank yous are especially nice. You know, people who, you know, from all walks of life who send me private, you know, DMs or emails saying, hey, this happened to me too. Or, you know, I also grew up in this way, or, you know, I'm in recovery and thank you for seeing me and adding my story to the history. That feels incredible because, you know, part of what I wanted to do for the book was reduce or eliminate the stigma around this conversation as much as I could. You know, we kind of talked about it earlier, but I grew up very poor in Columbus, Ohio, raised by a single mother with two sisters in a neighborhood that was hard hit by crack. And my mom, thank God for her, you know, protected us really, really well and sheltered us from things happening literally down the street. But I grew up kind of ashamed of the fact that that's the soil that I was planted in. And because, you know, a part of the way that we talked about neighborhoods like mine was that they were irredeemable and illegitimate in many ways. So it made it difficult to go into, you know, the world of journalism, which is very elite, and to say, I too have something to say when I come from a neighborhood and a community that people don't see any value in, that people would rather, you know, turn completely away from. So I know how hard it was for me to tell my own story, you know, of, you know, having my very first bike stolen by a drug addict, you know, in the way that that shapes you, you know, as a child.
Right.
And, but I felt like it was so necessary to tell that story so other people could then tell their stories.
Yeah. Right. It's saying, you know, even though you weren't directly impacted by this, you were on the periphery of it, you were indirectly impacted by it. And the impact being that you grew up maybe feeling less than, feeling like your voice wasn't as meaningful, as important. And then, so where does that leave the others who were at the center of this epidemic? And it just really demonstrates the, like, the scale of this problem and that history continuing to play out in modern times.
Yeah, absolutely. Wow. And, you know, and I think that, you know, we all were impacted in ways that we might not even completely understand. Like, just the fear of crime that exists, I think, within our society. Like, we live in a very fearful society, that we live with that fear. And that fear was really stoked during the 80s and the 90s, that if, you know, you were a kid that sat through the very special episodes of your favorite sitcom, you know, which were...
What were the shows? Like, different
Saved
Strokes.
Saved by the Bell had
Saved
one.
Saved by the Bell.
The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air had a drug
show.
Episode.
Yeah.
Yeah, wow. There was always an episode about drugs or about guns and violence.
Well, and that was one of my other questions for you, is that, you know, we've talked about the involvement of law enforcement and even media and the medical industry in sort of fueling that fear. But thank you for also bringing up, you know, Friday's lineup of, you know, television that we all watched and the after school specials. And everyone had a hand in this to some extent, whether they were very intentional about it or just playing that same tune because that's what was popular and that was what everybody was buying into this. So let's just keep it going. There was profit to be made when these stories were sensationalized. Fear sells. I mean, yes. I write about it in A Healthy State of Panic. It's like, we are so familiar with fear, not just because it is a natural resource in our bodies, but because the world plays on that. The 24/7 news cycle, marketing, it's like this always the sense of urgency and, you know, crime and, you know, everything is high stakes and life threatening and doesn't help, you know. But whew, yeah.
Thank I mean, you. Think about this, that like the people that gave us most of our drug messaging in the 80s and 90s was the I think it's the National Institute for a Drug-Free America. And this was literally a group of marketers that were funded by the Reagan administration to create all of those incredibly memorable ads, like "This is your brain on drugs."
This is your brain on drugs. Frightening, yes. Commercials.
Frightening, right? But like, you know, these weren't scientists. These weren't, you know, journalists. These weren't people that were accountable in those kind of ways to give accurate messaging. They were trying to evoke a feeling, which is what marketing does. And that's who we put the messaging around drug abuse, drug dealing, all of that, we like put it in their hands in a really funny way too. You know, I also came across all this great documentation about the Reagans, who were entertainers before they were politicians, both Nancy and Ronald Reagan.
They know drama.
They know drama, and that they literally held meetings with the heads of networks saying, how can we work drug anti-drug messaging into the show? So this is why Nancy Reagan is on an episode of Different Strokes. Mm-hmm. This is why Jesse Spano says, I'm so excited, I'm so excited, I'm so scared, mm-hmm. right? Like, because it was literally coordinated messaging about drugs, which, you know, on one hand, I think it did terrify a generation of young people and probably had some impact on.
I mean, it's why I didn't want to be Jesse Spano. I mean, kids were in my high school were taking all sorts of things to help them stay up at night to do their homework, you know, caffeine pills. And I was like, no, that is not how I'm leaving the earth. Like, and maybe there would be a small percentage of chance of that happening. But I was like, that is in my control to choose to take this or not. I saw what happened on Saved by the Bell. I'm not doing it.
Same. Yeah, no, terrified of drugs. And I think that, again, it's probably
in that way.
Absolutely.
But tell us the other side of it.
You know, but, you know, it's like you get that effect, but at what cost? Which is to create misinformation about drugs that then adds to additional harm, shame, and stigma. Mm-hmm. So for someone like me, you know, growing up in a neighborhood that was hard hit, I didn't want to become an addict. I didn't want to be a dealer. I was afraid of the addicts and the dealers around me. But also I had to deal with a level of policing in my neighborhood as a response, right? Mm-hmm. So I was, you know, from every turn, you know, harassed by the police, afraid of the violence in my community. And, you know, and there was just no letting up. And all of that as a byproduct, right, of that fear and hysteria.
This is your brain on drugs. Any questions?
Yeah.
If you have questions, turn to Donovan Ramsey. He's got answers, the real answers. The book is called When Crack Was King, A People's History of a Misunderstood Era. Brian Stevenson, author of Just Mercy, an incredible book. He says the book is insightful, deeply moving. Donovan Ramsey, thank you so much. And what's next?
Podcasting, Farnoosh.
You're going to start a podcast?
I'm going to start a podcast. It's very early on, but I realized during writing this book that I really love interviewing, that I almost write so I can interview. And so in thinking about how I could, you know, move my work forward, I felt like I wanted to incorporate more interviewing. I really feel like there's such a need for experimentation with like the Black voice and Black vocal expression. And there's such an audience again to build for Black listeners in the podcasting space.
Oh yeah.
So that's what I want to do.
Please do that. And I will help you. And the word I was searching for that was on the pages of your book, deeply feeling.
Authoritative. Oh, that's so nice of them.
Authoritative and deeply feeling. This is from the One World team, your publishers, who I think published President Obama's book.
You know what? Not Obama. That is Crown.
Okay.
And I will have you know that Crown did make me an offer for
Farnoosh. He wanted your book. Right. That's where I got confused.
And I said, no, I want to go with One World because they published Bryan Stevenson. They published Ta-Nehisi Coates. They published Nicole Hannah-Jones. And I really knew that they would handle the book well. So I went against my better Farnoosh advice and I left a little bit of money on the table. But I hope that we'll pick it up on the back end.
No, I mean, you do that sometimes because you want the right fit.
Yes.
This is a long journey. Book writing is not a quick race. It is a long, steady marathon, and you have won this marathon. Donovan Ramsey, thank you so much. We'll put the link in our show notes. I am so in awe of you. Congratulations. What else can I say? I mean, maybe someday, thank you. Maybe there's like a world where we can hug actually virtually. Yes. I can transcend the screen and give you a hug, but know that that is what I really want to do. And in absence of that, I'm just going to say, I heart you.
Thank you so much, Varnish. And wait a minute. Have you turned to the acknowledgments of the book yet?
Yes, of course. I know. I feel like, look, everybody. Well, you pointed that out for me. I know my tendency is to first go to an acknowledgement. I just didn't, honestly, it didn't even cross my mind that you would thank me.
Are you kidding me?
But I mean, it makes sense. No, I mean, I appreciate it. Of course. I mean, to think that I had any hand in this masterpiece being completed, well, I'm going to put that in my LinkedIn profile. Acknowledged in When Crack Was King, starting in 2023 till
present. Yeah, right. Absolutely.
That's a great job title. That's going to be the Chiron when I go on like Morning America. And joining us now, host of So Money and credited in the acknowledgments of When Crack Was King, Varnish Taravi.
I can't wait.
We're done. Okay. Donovan, be well, my friend.
All right. You too. We'll talk soon.
Thanks so much to Donovan for joining us. I have the link to his book in our show notes, and I'll be giving away a copy of this book. If you want it, let me know. Leave a review in our Apple Podcasts review section, and I might pick you next Friday on Ask Farnoosh. Hope you have a great rest of your Monday, and I'll see you back here soon. I hope your day is so money. Hosting the So Money podcast for almost 10 years, I've been learning a lot about how to best serve you outside the show. I've begun to offer pop-up workshops and a So Money members club. And with each new line of business, a lot goes on behind every transaction. Stripe helps simplify and ease payments with Tap to Pay on iPhone, which helps me grow revenue and reach through accepting more in-person contactless payments when I'm out in real life promoting my programs. Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe give me the ability to scale quickly and stay flexible with quick setup and no additional hardware required. And it's not just ideal for me. From local pop-ups to global retailers, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe help businesses of all sizes accept contactless payments right from an iPhone. Whether your customers want to use their card, Apple Pay, or other digital wallet, now you can accept contactless payments right from an iPhone. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.